We get into plenty of conversations about human behavior and the workings of the brain. We know a whole lot more about the brain's inner workings now because of the use of magnetic resonance imagery, MRI. Functional MRI allows us to look into brains in real time, a motion picture. But the owner of the brain can't move while the scan is going on, which is what makes Gregory Burns' work so amazing. He and his coworkers got dogs to stay still long enough to have fMRI scans done to register how their brains react to stimulus. The results are written up in the book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. Gregory Burns is an MD and a PhD and a professor of psychology at Emory University in Atlanta. He's the director of the Center for Neuropolicy and the Facility for Education and Research in Neuroscience there. His previous books include How Dogs Love Us. Gregory Burns, hello and thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
You own several dogs. Do they ever look at you as if they're wondering what you think about them?
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, one of them is particularly attuned to me, and she was actually the first dog to be trained for the MRI. The others I'm not so sure about.
You know, the lineage is pretty amazing here. Apparently the raid to kill Osama bin Laden led to the work detailed in the book. How?
Yeah, I think I'm probably the only person in the country who can say that. But what happened was when that mission happened and I saw the pictures of the dog jumping out of the helicopter, so that dog's name was Cairo, it actually gave me the idea that if dogs can be trained to jump out of helicopters, then we could certainly train a dog to go into an MRI because they're both noisy environments.
Indeed. So what aspect of the training gets the dogs? I mean, the dogs, they don't get earplugs, I'm thinking.
They do get earplugs. That's part
of
the training.
Ah.
So for many years I've been studying the human brain using MRI to see primarily how reward systems and incentives work in the human brain. So it was kind of a natural transition for me to move it into dogs. And, of course, I started with my own dog and teamed up with a dog trainer to just break it down into pieces. And so the whole idea of this project was to treat dogs not as research subjects but as active participants and volunteers, kind of like children participating in a research project. And so we just broke down the elements. I created a simulator, a tube. I built mock-ups of the receiver coils that they would have to put their head in. I made a little foam chin rest that they could put their head in. And then we started playing the sounds of the scanner, which sounds kind of like a jackhammer. And we started at low volume. And the idea was to play with the dogs while all of this was happening to try to get it to be a game for them. And it took about 2 months, I think, to get my dog ready for it. It was a lot of trial and error. But in hindsight, it's not as hard as it sounds.
Well, I'm still stuck on the idea of not getting them in there. I mean, you can convince a dog to do a lot of things, but I mean, once the noise starts up and everything, I mean, that's hard for a lot of humans to take. And the idea that a dog will actually stay there and remain motionless is amazing. And then once they're in there, what stimulus did they give them to so you could record what their brains were doing?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The noise is the hardest part of it for them. And it's not for all dogs. So, you know, if dogs are noise sensitive or maybe they have thunder phobia, they may not be the best candidates for this. But I can say that, you know, now after 6 years of doing this, we've trained over 90 dogs to be what we call MRI certified and have a pretty good sense of what dogs can do and what kind of triggers them. But once they're in there, and they've been practicing this, then we can do essentially the same things that we do with humans in there. And we've done everything from show them food, show them, you know, their owner praising them. We've shown them pictures of faces. We've even done tasks where they have to put on the brakes and the task of self-control. So really what the project is about is kind of a top-to-bottom mapping of the dog brain and what makes them tick.
Wow. So what did this, just as a starter, what were some of the things that the sessions and the machine showed you?
So I think probably one of the more interesting experiments we did, and this was a couple of years ago now, we wanted to know if dogs essentially come wired to process us socially, kind of, you know, why do they look at our faces, where most animals will not look you in the face, at least not only as a threat or a kind of interpreted as aggression. But, you know, dogs readily look at us like we look at each other. And previously, it had been known in humans and other primates like monkeys and chimpanzees that there are dedicated parts of the visual system for processing faces. In fact, in primates, we call it the face area. So we wanted to know if dogs had something similar to that. And what it involved was, you know, having the dogs in the scanner and then showing them pictures. And these pictures were things like pictures of dogs, pictures of humans, and then as control stimuli, we would show them pictures of everyday objects and maybe natural scenes. And what was amazing is just like humans, they too have a dedicated part of their visual system for processing faces, which shows that it's deeply wired in their DNA.
Which should tell us that it's not just a matter of chance that the dog can recognize people.
Well, we didn't, you know, the recognition question is very interesting, and we tried to look at that as well, though we didn't come to any solid conclusions about, you know, exactly how dogs recognize people. I mean, it could be partially visual, but I suspect it also involves other senses like smell, because we actually did another experiment even before that where we presented odors to the dogs while they were in the scanner, and these odors included their own scent. It included the scent of another dog in their household, a strange dog that they've never met. It included the scent of their owner as well as a person that they never met. And what was interesting about that experiment was that when we looked in the reward systems of their brains while this was happening, only the scent of the familiar human was the one that activated the reward center, indicating that they recognized the scent as coming from their person and that there was a positive association to it that they essentially anticipated and liked.
So, I mean, do they actually get does the reward hormone? Does that get secreted in their brains when they smell our smells?
Well, yeah, this part of the brain is heavily innervated by dopamine, same as in humans. So undoubtedly, that's part of it. There's also been some recent data showing that the hormone oxytocin, which goes by various names and perhaps not too accurately as the love hormone. But anyway, they also release oxytocin when they look into certain people's eyes, apparently.
Wow. Your dog's brain at work, as revealed by Gregory Burns in his book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take your phone calls and emails in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Gregory Burns, professor of psychology at Emory University in Atlanta. He's also an MD, and so he has learned a lot about body structures and how we use our brains, but has branched off into other animals. He actually got dogs to sit, stay, and remain in an MRI so their brains could be scanned while various stimuli were given to them. His results are placed in the book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. You can join the conversation on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You do acknowledge some controversy with the work, Dr. Burns. Are we trying hard to, too hard perhaps, to compare dogs to people?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, when you look at enough brains, especially of mammals, so we're all mammals, it's inevitable that you're going to see structures that are essentially the same from one species to another. And so when you are comparing dog brains to human brains, the obvious difference is size. So they clearly do not have the same real estate that we do. But they're also smaller than us. And so a lot of brain size just goes with body size. But even after you account for that, they have some things that we have and some things that we don't have. So I see a lot of similarities in many of the core processes related to things like emotions and feelings. So it seems clear that they have positive feelings, very much like we do. But yet they don't have the ability to label them like we do. And so that's probably the biggest difference. You know, obviously they don't have language where we do. But that doesn't mean that they don't experience things in ways that are similar.
So we have to be careful to say that we do have similar brain structures, but that doesn't tell us much about how they actually think or act.
Well, I think it does, actually. I think we get closer to this. In fact, I think we can get closer to what it's like to be a dog than simply by looking at them from the outside. And that's really a big reason why I'm doing this work, is just the frustration with trying to figure out what a dog might be thinking just from their behavior, because we inevitably anthropomorphize, you know, what's happening in a dog. And kind of the first thing you learn about dog research is that everyone's an expert. Everyone thinks they know what yeah. their dog is thinking. So I think by using this technology, we can actually build what we call a functional map of certain regions in the brain that are active when dogs are either doing certain things that we can measure or experiencing things, say, in a positive way. So the example, for example, is how are they anticipating the receipt of food versus the receipt of some kind of social reward. And so we can use specific structures in the brain to get a measure of how much more do they like food or just being with their person. And that gives us some insight into at least their motivations and what they might think.
Well, right to that point, though, I mean, are there different parts of the brain that respond to the reward of, like, hey, I'm going to get fed versus, hey, I'm going to get to spend time with my person?
Well, it seems that it all flows through a common set of regions, which we call the caudate nucleus. And this is an area of the brain that we have as well. It's the part of the brain that's rich in dopamine receptors. And so what we can do is use that kind of like a little meter on how much an individual is anticipating or liking something. So when we see activity in that area, and let's say it's more to the expectation that their human is going to pop into view and say, good girl, than it is to a cue that says you're going to get a piece of food, well, then we can interpret that as, hey, you know, the dog is liking and expecting more from that praise than the food itself. Now, the caveat with that, and I've been kind of talking in generalities about dogs, and actually the more interesting thing is that the dogs are all different. And this is, I guess, not too surprising because we see the same thing in human studies, but we can essentially rank the dogs based on their relative preference or at least their brain's preference for these things, and then that corresponds to what they do outside of the scanner when we give them choices. So I do feel that, you know, by looking into the brain, we are gaining insights that we simply can't get from their outward behaviors.
So the dogs are individuals. They have different things that excite them.
Yeah, of course they do. And we actually did another experiment. This was in conjunction with service dogs. So we teamed up with a service dog training group called Canine Companions for Independence. And we asked the question is, could we use this brain imaging to scan some of their essentially puppies, not quite puppies, a little older than puppies, but dogs that were selected for service dog training before they actually go through the training and see if we could predict which dogs would end up being good assistance animals. And so they incorporated the MRI training into their overall training process, and then at a certain point we would scan them on one of our tests and see if we could make a model that predicted the outcome, and then we just waited. And what happened was that we could actually use the brain data to do a fair bit better than even the trainers themselves in predicting which dogs would be good service animals. And what this means is that there's information inside the dog's brain that doesn't quite come out to their behavior, you know, even with experienced handlers. It's like they're keeping stuff inside, even call it their thought or emotional processes. But eventually, it rings true to their personalities.
Wow, we're talking about what it's like to get inside the brain of a dog, which Dr. Gregory Burns and his team did at Emory University as they put dogs into fMRI scanners and got a chance to see what's in there. It's called What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. I did notice that Adrian Owen is mentioned in the book. He was on the Jefferson Exchange just a couple of months ago. How did his work lead to you?
So Adrian's work is quite fascinating. And so the thing that I'm taken with is his work specifically on people in vegetative states. So, you know, what he did was he used the same technology, he used fMRI on people essentially in comas and showed that even though there's no outward sign of really any consciousness because they're in a coma, when you speak to them, he found evidence that in fact they seem to be processing or their brains are processing some of the content that's coming into their ears. And to me, that's incredibly important because it shows that internal experiences can become separated or disconnected from outward behavior. And in that case, you really can't infer anything from outward appearances. And so it's a very similar situation with animals. Because they can't speak to us, you know, until now, all we have is their outward behavior, and sometimes, you know, we don't know what that means. So by going inside the brain, we learn more.
So with the dogs you're working with, you came up with the go, no-go test. This was really fascinating stuff. What is that?
Yeah, so the go, no-go task is a test of impulse control or self-control. And the inspiration for that was a very old test called the marshmallow test, which was invented in the 60s. And this was the marshmallow test was done in children. And the idea was that these kids were placed in a room, and they were told that if they wait, say, 10 minutes, they would get a marshmallow or a cookie or something that they really liked. And then so they were just left in the room. And if they waited, they got the treat. But if they couldn't wait anymore, they could ring a bell, and then the researcher would come back and give them something else, although not as good. So some kids could wait it out, and then they got their treat, and other kids couldn't. Now, what's interesting about that is that the kids who could wait, essentially delay gratification, did much better later in life. They had higher SAT scores. They had higher incomes. They just basically did better in everything. And what this showed is that the ability to delay gratification or impulse control is a very useful skill in our society. So we wanted to ask a similar question about dogs. Now, dogs are not generally known to be masters of self-control, although they can do it. But, you know, the fact is that they don't have as large a prefrontal lobe as we do, which is the area of the brain necessary for doing this sort of stuff. And when they don't have self-control, it gets them in trouble. And, you know, for dogs, sometimes it leads to them being dumped at a shelter, you know. So things like peeing in the house, chewing furniture, general destruction, biting, those are all impulse control problems. So we wanted to know what part of the brain in the dog is doing this, and does it correspond to the same part of the brain in humans? So the go, no-go task is very simple. So what we did was we trained the dogs with a dog whistle. When they heard a dog whistle, they had to just touch their nose to a target that we put in front of their face. And that's called the go signal. That was easy to train. After they learned that, then we taught them that a hand signal, when the person raised their arms in kind of an X, meant don't poke the target even if you hear the whistle. And that's a very hard thing to do because it basically kind of means they have to put on the brakes to inhibit their tendency to nose poke this target. They do this in the scanner, and what we found is when they successfully put on the brakes, they have activity in exactly the corresponding part of their prefrontal lobes as humans do doing that task. So it's yet another piece of evidence kind of showing how to map dog brains into human brains and showing that they are using similar processes. And also, like humans, the dogs who had more activity there did better on the task, and they also did better on other tasks of self-control outside the scanner. And so it kind of links this picture of how dogs do things and why some dogs are better at it than others. The dogs who are good simply have better prefrontal lobe function than others. And so this begins to suggest ways perhaps to change training with dogs, you know, identify dogs maybe who have impulse control problems and target not just their behavior, but maybe even do a sort of cognitive therapy and target activity in their brain and reinforce that.
We're talking again with Dr. Gregory Burns at Emory University. He's the director of the Center for Neuropolicy and the Facility for Education and Research in Neuroscience. He's been putting dogs in the fMRI to get an idea of what goes on in their brains. The research is in his book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. There are other animals mentioned in here, and we'll talk about those as we move along here. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So it seems like one of the issues you have right up front is that the dogs who you're really wondering what's going on in their heads when they're doing things wrong, you can't get them to stay in the MRI.
That is absolutely right. And, you know, we have to have a tryout process for this. So pretty much we rely on volunteer network of people in Atlanta and elsewhere. And we hold a tryout process to see which dogs, you know, will actually enjoy doing this. And clearly not all dogs can do this. And it's, you know, right now that's a limitation we have. But I think, you know, going forward, we hope to, you know, work with some of these more difficult dogs. We actually had started a pilot program with one of the jail dogs programs here in Atlanta to see if those dogs could be trained for the MRI, because they often take some of the more difficult cases from the shelter. So I think we may still be able to do that. It needs funding to keep that kind of thing going, but that would be the way to go.
You take a good aside to all this in a chapter called Why a Brain, which brings up the basic sensitivity of the brain. I mean, it's just an amazing instrument, isn't it?
It is, you know, and you know, it's so easy to take it for granted, but the fact is, you know, we have very little consciousness of what our brain is actually doing. And in fact, you know, nobody can agree on what consciousness is in the first place. But my view of brains is that brains evolved first to help animals do things, that they are fundamentally this organism that has to control a body, and the fact that you only have one body and that you can only do one thing at a time, and you have to make decisions about that. And then everything else just enables that. That is kind of its overall purpose.
Well, the idea that you point out in the book that the big body equals a big brain. I mean, if you have a nervous system, you have muscles, and vice versa. If you have muscles, you have a nervous system. So it makes more, because I've wondered for years why horses don't take over the world, but the answer is because they have big bodies. I shouldn't expect them to do calculus either.
Yeah, that's right. So it's somewhat of a mystery and kind of not well understood, but as animals get bigger, their brains get bigger, although not in what we call a linear fashion. So it's not just a one-to-one relationship. There's kind of it's a law of diminishing returns. Now, humans, of course, are kind of outliers on that scale, that our brains are bigger than expected for body size. And presumably, that extra brain tissue is what makes us human, although, to be honest, I mean, even that assumption is kind of coming under question these days. And really, not a week goes by now where we see some report of some other animal that can do very human-like things, you know, birds, particularly crows, being probably the best example, that they have very small brains, but they can do a lot of problem-solving tasks.
Yeah, I noticed that with the pebbles in the water and all the stuff that they have figured out, in a sense, using tools. There is a portion of the book where we're not just talking about dogs in the MRI. I did promise other animals here that, for example, you were scanning some brains of dead sea lions, and this all starts actually with a weird disease in Montreal in 1987 involving humans. What happened there?
Yeah, so as we got into the animal research, we actually started having other brains sent to us, and so these are brains from animals that either died or had to be euthanized because they were in rehab facilities and they were sick. So we started getting these brains, and so we started doing a different type of MRI scan. It's called diffusion tensor imaging. And what that does is it allows us to build up a complete 3D map of all the connections in the brain. And then by analyzing what's connected to what, you start to build the equivalent of a road map of how information flows. And so the sea lion project is interesting because, especially in the Pacific, there has been a record number of stranding of sea lions, particularly in California, over the last couple of years. Now, a lot of this is a result of El Nino, but some of these cases, the sea lions strand on the beach and they have seizures. And it's kind of like, I'm told, watching a drunk sea lion, if that makes any sense. They kind of walk and wobble around in circles. And it turns out that what they're doing, or what has happened, is that they've eaten a particular form of toxic algae, or actually they've eaten fish that have eaten the algae, and this contains a neurotoxin that has damaged their hippocampus, which is responsible for spatial navigation.
And this is domoic acid, which we've mentioned a few times on the program.
Oh, yeah, excellent. That is exactly what it is. And so we started studying these brains and trying to look at how the connections from the hippocampus to other parts of the sea lion's brain has been damaged. And what's interesting is that it mimics the pattern of what happened in Montreal now almost 30 or 40 years ago, when humans got the same domoic acid poisoning from eating contaminated mussels. And so this kind of reiterates a theme in the book, is that, you know, when you start looking at brains of many animals, you start to see similarities and patterns, both in function as well as when things go wrong.
Well, as long as we're talking about sea lions, let's stick there and actually talk about a live one, Ronan, and the sea lion with the great sense of rhythm. What happened here?
Yeah, so Ronan was a very special sea lion that had kind of repeatedly stranded herself. So Rona is a female. And, you know, she kept wandering down Highway 1, kind of around the Bay Area, and kept landing at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito. And so nobody was really sure what to do with her because she kept bouncing back every time they released her. So she was adopted by the Pinniped Lab in Santa Cruz to be, shall we say, a long-term resident and research participant there, where they take care of her and where she still lives. And so I had a postdoc in my lab, postdoctoral fellow, who came from Santa Cruz, and he had studied Ronan and had this idea that he could teach Ronan how to move in time to essentially different rhythms. And that idea came from a famous bird called Snowball. It was a crested cockatoo, and I think Snowball made the rounds of the talk shows probably about 10 years ago and had this ability to kind of bob his head in time to all sorts of songs, and apparently his favorite was the Backstreet Boys. And so Ronan showed that she could also do the same things, which is quite interesting, because previously it had been thought that only animals who had some kind of vocal flexibility, the ability to mimic things, could do rhythm, because many scientists have thought that rhythm and speech are linked. But Ronan showed that they're not necessarily the same thing, because sea lions can't speak.
Huh, interesting, but she can certainly rock to the music, and we'll talk a lot more about other brains and other animals and all the things that Gregory Burns has learned in the process of writing this book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. Back in the Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dr. Gregory Burns, MD, PhD, professor of psychology at Emory University in Atlanta. He and his team figured out that they could scan the brains of dogs in a functional MRI. That's the real-time MRI, by getting them to sit and stay in the MRI. They've discovered some really interesting things contained in the book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, to tell us what your dog is thinking. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Greg, I'm glad you're taking a side here on fMRIs themselves. I know we've had so many discussions about them here in the program. It seems like people are going to start putting slices of pizza in there pretty soon. But there are critics of this who've called the experiments blobology over the years. What were they complaining about?
Yeah, so the blobologists were just pointing out the fact that in human fMRI experiments, there's this tendency to publish pictures of brains with blobs of activity and point to them and say, well, this is the love area, or this is the, you know, whatever area of interest. And the blobologists say, well, that doesn't tell us anything. That's just like phrenology. So that critique is valid to a certain extent, although I would say that the field has moved on quite a bit beyond simply just labeling parts of the brain and trying to understand better how the circumstances, what circumstances actually result in activity in particular areas, as well as how areas kind of functionally connect to each other.
So by the time you began the dog project, was there any reluctance on your part based on some of the retrenching of fMRI use?
Well, the dog project really just started as a side thing and just a crazy idea, could we do this? And then when it became clear that, yeah, we can do this, then it was back to asking the right questions and just laying the groundwork for understanding the dog's brain. So there, you know, prior to this, there really wasn't any kind of functional map of the dog brain. It would be very hard to say what each part did. And so it kind of, in view of that, I think it's a very important and worthwhile activity. Not because it really tells us much about human health, and I get asked that question a lot. It's like, well, what does this to say about humans? And the answer is, well, not a whole lot, because this project isn't about humans. It's about the dogs, understanding what dogs are and, you know, perhaps where they came from.
We mentioned food versus praise a little bit earlier, and the fact that there will be some pleasure center operations going on depending on what appeals to each individual dog. This leads us to talk about Buridan's ass, and yes, we do mean the animal. What is that about?
So Buridan's ass is kind of the, shall we say, the positive analogy to Sophie's Choice. So I think most people have heard of Sophie's Choice, which is having to choose between two awful outcomes. Buridan's ass is named after, it's kind of a philosophy problem from an ass, a donkey, probably around the 1500s. And the idea is that a donkey is placed in between a pile of straw and a bucket of water. And being so hungry and so thirsty, the donkey's paralyzed by indecision and then essentially starves to death because he can't choose. So that's Buridan's ass.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it's interesting. People, I think, also suffer from this problem where, you know, we often have kind of this array of choices of things that we like and we can't decide, so we don't end up choosing at all. And so this food versus praise experiment that we did with the dogs is very much analogous to that, because we know that dogs like food. We know that they like the social bond of their owner. And if we put them in a situation of having to choose, which we did, the question is, what will they do? And so by bringing in the brain imaging, it gives us a better picture of how they puzzle through this choice. And what's interesting about it is it's like you kind of have these competing choices in their head. You know, it's almost like the famous scene from Animal House, which I won't describe. But
I know which one.
Yeah. The dog's like there. It's like, oh, do I go for the food or do I go for my person? Food, person. So you can literally see this unfolding in activity in the dog's brain. And the dogs who kind of have equal activity to both are the ones who kind of vacillate back and forth when we actually put them in the test.
Do they finally make a choice, though?
Yeah, they have to, because they get released into this room with a maze, and ultimately they do make a choice. But if we repeat that choice, in which we did it 20 times for each dog, those dogs tend to vacillate back and forth. So they'll kind of sample owner, food. And a few dogs just sometimes get puzzled by it and just then wander around the room unable to choose at all.
It's really good that you point out the fact that humans can make a choice and still sometimes think about the one they didn't take. I mean, so some level of regret there. Did you find any of that in the animals?
Well, so the regret is really interesting. So we have not studied this in dogs, but what's amazing is a test of regret has been shown in rats. You know, laboratory rats kind of trained on a similar type of task where they get to choose different values of food. And if they make a choice for something that they know is not their favorite, they will kind of look back towards the other thing literally as if they're thinking about what might have been. It's unbelievable, but if rats kind of have evidence that they regret things, it's a sure bet that dogs do as well.
Yeah, that's probably an easy assumption. So let's talk about how emotions might compare. I mean, dare we speak of love that dogs have for us, or is it the old belief that they're just waiting for us to drop food on the floor? My dog seems to love me more when I'm eating something because I might get some stuff on my chest on the couch.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem when we talk about love is the word itself. So we humans apply that word to so many different types of relationships that we have that it kind of glosses over it. So I have no problem labeling the emotion that dogs have for us, even if you take away the food, love, because, I mean, that's a kind of love that we have as well. I mean, it's not romantic love. Maybe it's something like friendship. It's a little bit hard to find the exact word, but I think it's more of a human labeling problem, but it's a feeling that I think we all personally understand, because I think we've all personally felt it, that it's just the feeling of wanting to be with a person just for its own sake, not transactional on, you know, what is this person going to do for me? Is they going to earn money? Is it about sex? I mean, it's not about any of those things, and that's probably closer to what dogs feel.
So while we're busy wondering what dogs think, what do they think about the things that we might be thinking? There's obviously some back play here, and I was really fascinated by the discussion about the dogs who know enough to not just look at the finger, but to look where the finger is pointing.
Yeah, so this is kind of an ongoing debate in the field of canine science, which is, you know, dogs are really good at reading our behavior. So that's called a theory of behavior. They can kind of pick up very subtle cues, like we might, you know, have tells and we might kind of have these subtle movements. But do they actually understand that we have a mind of our own, that there's kind of something inside of this body? And so the pointing task is kind of one piece of evidence that suggests that they might, meaning that they understand that when we point to something, it means kind of don't look at my finger, look at the thing that I'm pointing at. So, you know, that was originally thought to be kind of very special because many primates can't seem to learn that. But what's interesting is when that kind of task was done in wolves, it was shown that wolves can do that actually even better than dogs, so it's not something special for dogs. And as far as kind of a theory of mind, knowing that there's kind of somebody here, not just kind of this moving creature, I think the evidence is suggesting that, like people, there's tremendous variation. So some dogs probably have that ability or just better at it than other dogs, and other dogs just may not ever get it. You know, I have a few of those dogs.
How many dogs do you have altogether? All it says in your bio is you have too many dogs.
Well, at the house presently, there's four.
Four, okay.
Yeah.
That's a house load. The discussion, though, about whether dogs know what we're asking them for, directing them to do, hand signals aside, I mean, how much did you find out about dogs and language and whether they can determine which different words we're using?
Yeah, so the language question is paramount because obviously dogs don't speak, so they don't have any output of language. But the question is, what do they understand of what we say? And it still, to this day, it amazes me that they understand anything that we say because, we just have a stream of gibberish, frankly, that comes out of our mouths frequently without much content. And it's amazing that the dogs pick up anything from that. So we've done some early experiments with this to try to figure this out by essentially teaching the dogs that the names of specific objects. So there was a famous dog a few years ago called Chaser, who knows that 1,000 objects, and we wanted to see how the dogs process this. And it turns out that although they can make these associations, they seem to be doing it in ways very different than humans. It seems to be very much based on just sheer novelty of sounds.
So it just sounds enough different from the other one. So it sounds like if we're trying to teach our dog something, we need to make sure that the words sound very different from each other?
I think that probably helps, and I think using less words will help even more.
Ah, okay. Shorter sentences, for sure. I want to, before we run out of time, I do want to ask about Tasmanian tigers, which are in the book as well. I've kind of glossed over dolphins and things like that. There are lots of other creatures in the book, but Tasmanian tigers in particular, these have been extinct since the 1930s by anybody's official estimate. How did these enter your work?
Yeah, I got obsessed with these creatures, and the Tasmanian tiger looked remarkably like a dog, kind of probably closer to a coyote, except they are not dogs, they're not coyotes, they're not even canids because they're marsupials. And they lived only in Australia and Tasmania until they went extinct 100 years ago. And I became obsessed with them because what I wanted to know was if they had this outward appearance of looking like dogs, what did their brains look like? And if we could look at their brains, would that tell us anything about what it was like to be a Tasmanian tiger? So that's how I got obsessed with this. And then that led to a two-year search to find out if there were any brains left intact from the Tasmanian tiger. And it turns out that there are four, precisely four, known to exist in the world.
Wow.
One of which is held by the Smithsonian. And so the Smithsonian was kind enough to lend theirs to me to scan to see what we could learn about it. And so therein kind of was this long odyssey of looking at Tasmanian tiger brains and then needing something to compare it to, then I started looking at the brains of Tasmanian devils, which are related and still alive. And so the answer is that despite their outward appearances, their brains actually looked quite a bit different. And that reflects the fact that they are probably about 150 million years removed from dogs evolutionarily. And so it's just fascinating how they evolved to do very similar things as coyotes do, but their brains are wired somewhat differently.
Well, they're fascinating to look at, too. The pictures, there were lots of photographs taken of thylacines before they were extinct, and they're pretty amazing looking. I did think about the Tasmanian devil in the cartoons when I was looking at the pictures of the Tasmanian tigers. So I have to ask, Greg, from all this work, has your behavior toward your dogs changed?
It has. In particular, Callie, who's the first dog to do this, you know, what I noticed is that by working together on this project, it really strengthened our bond, and it reminded me that, you know, how dogs evolved are not, it wasn't to be lap creatures. They evolved to do things with us, and you know, when we're doing things with them, it's just something utterly unique and great.
Have animal rights supporters taken an interest in your work for the potential implications of our treatment of other animals?
Oh, for sure. And, you know, it's really undeniable, and it's changed kind of my view of not only dogs, but really all animals. You know, when you start to see these parallels and evidence that their brains can support sentience, meaning they're aware of a lot more than we realize, then you really have to question how we treat animals, you know, especially with regards to food and clothing.
Are there any things in particular back to dogs, then, that we should not be doing to our dogs or doing in front of them, conversations we might have in other rooms, for example, without the dogs being present?
No, I don't think it goes quite that far. I think, you know, what I've endeavored to do is try to be clearer in my communications with them and also to be more attuned to what they try to tell us.
Do the experiments continue? Are you still putting dogs in the fMRI these days?
Absolutely. You know, we've like I said, we've trained over 90 dogs for this now. The things that they can do equals what humans are doing in the scanner. So we're looking at things like learning and going deeper into language.
It is fascinating work. It's all contained in the book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. A lot of other creatures we didn't mention here. Gregory Burns at Emory University is the author of the book, and he's been our guest on The Exchange today. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.